This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/marketplace, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/marketplace now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing a wide range of tax-exempt portfolios. Details at putnam.com. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Hi, my name's Unemployment. I've come to rain on your parade. Yeah, I know oil prices are down, and some are talking about hitting bottom in the housing crisis. But let me ask you this while I have you. How much do you think the economy is really going to grow if people keep losing their jobs? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act. And by Gather.com, where friends keep up with the people, conversations, and moments that matter most. People are talking about the economy at Gather.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Great to have you here on this Friday. It's the 5th of September today. And I'll just cut right to the chase here and give you the numbers. The unemployment rate hit 6.1% in August. That's the highest it's been in nearly 5 years. And for the 8th time in a row, the economy had fewer jobs at the end of the month than it did at the beginning. 84,000 fewer. In all, the economy's down more than 600,000 jobs since the beginning of the year, which sounds pretty bad. But the real story might be even uglier. Marketplace's Steve Henn reports.
You can sum up this month's job report in one word: yuck.
There's no positive spin on it. It was bad.
Mark Zandi at economy.com says weakness in the labor market hit housing first, but now it's spreading to business professionals, factory workers, and retail clerks. Economist Peter Morisi says the official unemployment rate understates the problem.
If we factor in discouraged workers, unemployment's about 7.6%.
Since 2000, Morisi says more than 2 million Americans have simply stopped looking for work and aren't counted in the official unemployment numbers.
We lost last month 69,000 jobs in construction and manufacturing. Historically, those are the sectors that high school graduates and people with a few years of college but no specialized skill can find the best paying jobs. Instead, they're pushed into activities like being hotel clerks, waiting on tables, and so forth. Often those jobs don't pay enough to cover things like childcare for a young couple.
As good jobs vanished, men dropped out of the labor force. But for years, women picked up the slack.
As more women went to work and as women became better educated, but even women's earnings have now hit the wall.
Demographer Cheryl Russell is author of Bet You Didn't Know. She says today, women are leaving the workforce too. And if that trend continues, it will have historic consequences.
It's the end of the rise of the American standard of living.
In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
Once the closing bell rings, it's tempting to stop paying attention to the markets. But I draw your attention to the world of after-hours trading right now. Both Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac are up electronically. Could be this news that hit the Wall Street Journal website late this afternoon, that the Treasury Department is putting the finishing touches on a plan to shore up the two mortgage giants. We could know more perhaps as soon as Sunday. Back in the early days of personal computers, Dell's trademark was building its products to order.
The company built a lot of factories, too, to do that. But now it's looking to revamp its signature production process. The Wall Street Journal reports today Dell is talking about selling off most of its facilities and having somebody else make its computers. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports.
Up till now, Dell has relied primarily on its own factories in the U.S. and overseas to custom make computers that were ordered directly by customers. Analysts say that getting away from that production model would help the company cut costs in a very competitive industry. Dell is under pressure due to sagging sales and lower quarterly profits. Steve Biggs follows Dell for Zacks Equity Research.
While that model is still works for the North American business market, you know, a lot of Dell's revenue now is coming from the consumer market and from international, which is a different model, and controlling the manufacturing assets may be less necessary.
Increasingly, Dell's sales are to consumers shopping at retail stores rather than to businesses that order a whole raft of customized PCs at once. Plus, people are buying more laptops, which can be churned out cheaper by specialized contract manufacturers. Competitors like Hewlett-Packard already outsource most of their production, which allows them to focus on marketing and design. Technology analyst Stephen Baker of the NPD Group says we can expect to see more computer manufacturing move abroad.
It mostly happens in Taiwan, China, and in Vietnam increasingly. But in the U.S., a lot of those things end up in North America, end up in Mexico because of the cost differentials there as well.
That means Dell's overseas factories might be the most attractive to a buyer if they're put up for sale. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
On the topic of computers, have you heard of the nonprofit program called One Laptop Per Child? Last year, the group offered a Christmas special. For $400, you'd get a laptop for yourself, and a second would be sent to a child somewhere in the developing world. Almost 200,000 computers were sold, but getting them to where they were going turned into a fiasco. So for this holiday season, the group has teamed up with big business, as Marketplace's Dan Gretsch reports.
Last year, people snapped up the so-called EXO laptops, then waited months for them to be delivered. This time around, the EXO will be distributed by internet retail giant Amazon.com. Scott Cleland is with industry consultant Precursor.
Amazon has really now become kind of the electronic Walmart. You know, they just have massive warehouses and massive distribution network and a system to be an air traffic controller for requests coming in and getting the product out.
The One Laptop Per Child Foundation developed the EXO. Quanta, a Taiwanese computer maker, manufactured it. And a team of open source software developers created its operating system and applications. But Cleland says that kind of collaborative effort doesn't work for delivery.
When you're talking about world distribution, you know, that isn't something that you snap your fingers and people can do. It's not a self-organizing task.
At first, EXO's open-source operating system was seen as a threat to software titan Microsoft. Now Microsoft is a partner. It plans to include a version of Windows XP on the next generation of EXOs.
Corporate interests are often aligned with the goals of open source software.
Jim Zemlin directs the Linux Foundation, which promotes open source software. He says cheap laptops can help poor countries develop faster. They can also create a market for more expensive computers in the future. I'm Dan Gretsch for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, traders just took a deep breath and relaxed after yesterday's pounding. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Don't go telling Russian investors there's no downside to the Kremlin's invasion of Georgia. Moscow stepped in yesterday to shore up the ruble after it fell to its lowest level in a year and a half. That promptly sent the main Russian stock index sliding today. The proximate cause of all that, besides the invasion, is foreign investors taking their money and going home. Political troubles in Thailand have led to stock market trouble there, and Beijing is worried about how much money it's got in the bank, a situation caused in part because of economic problems here. From New York, Ashley Montite explains.
China has bought about $1 trillion worth of U.S. bonds during the last several years, treasury bonds and mortgage-backed securities guaranteed by Fannie and Freddie. The value of many of those bonds has been falling. Ted Fishman is the author of China, Inc. He says the slide in value is made worse for China because in the last few years, its currency has been strengthening.
That means that any investment that the Chinese have bought abroad goes down in terms of their own currency because the dollar is cheaper.
According to the New York Times, that drop in value of U.S. assets has caused China's central bank to begin scrambling to shore up its small capital base. But not everyone thinks it needs to. Ted Truman is a former central banker, now with the Peterson Institute for International Economics.
The capital of a central bank doesn't matter.
Why?
Because they print money.
Truman says some banks have gone for years with negative capital. He says China has plenty of assets, not least a huge pile of foreign exchange reserves. Still, he says the falling value of U.S. bonds has attracted critics in China.
If you want to criticize, looking for something to criticize the central bank, whether it's on its monetary policy or on its implementation of the foreign exchange policy, then you're the political whipping boy.
Or you could just blame America. Some in China believe the U.S. deliberately sold the central bank bonds it knew would lose value. I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
If you watched some of those television shots of the Olympics real closely, you probably noticed all the ads and billboards in the backgrounds. They weren't just for show. China's in the middle of a huge boom in consumer spending. That would seem to be good news for credit card companies, the chance to finance those new cars and flat-screen TVs, right? But that theory misses the way most of those transactions are actually happening. Lisa Chow reports now from Beijing.
First, let me give you a basis of comparison. In the U.S., when people buy stuff, they use cash one-third of the time. The rest of the time, they use personal checks, debit and credit cards, or they pay online. In China, people use cash 95% of the time. They'll buy plane tickets in cash. They'll pay their rent in cash. When you go to a bank in China, cash counting machines are a familiar sound. Out of 100 transactions, only one will be done by credit card. It seems surprising in a country known for its growing consumer culture. Quan Sen is CEO of the Shanghai Pudong Development Bank's credit card center. The bank is working with U.S.-based Citibank to issue credit cards in China.
My biggest competitor is cash. I'm fighting against the consumer behavior.
Part of what's driving this behavior, Sen says, is a lack of trust in the system. Think about it. Every time you hand over your credit card in the U.S., let's say to pay a restaurant bill, someone could be copying down your number. On top of that, the only thing that verifies that you've used your card is your signature. Sen says consumers in China insist on a PIN number.
People didn't trust. They don't think signature will represent you.
And so most credit cards in China work more like debit cards. There's also lack of trust between banks and consumers. In China, if you lose your credit card and someone else uses it, banks will hold you responsible for those charges. Because who's to say you didn't secretly give the card to a friend to buy a bunch of stuff for you? But the big obstacle for banks issuing credit cards is people in China don't like debt. In a main shopping district in Shanghai, Rong Zhaolong talks about his most recent big purchase. The retired engineer took out the equivalent of $430 in cash from his bank and walked directly to the store to buy a DVD player.
We have this traditional thinking. We don't like to spend more than what we have.
Not far away, 36-year-old Peng Jian is at a bank checking her account details. Peng follows Chinese tradition in that she doesn't have any loans and she saves about one-third of her salary. She does have two credit cards and she uses them a lot, but she never racks up interest charges.
Every month I pay off the entire balance. I've never carried a balance on my credit card. I think this is the biggest difference in the consumer behavior of Chinese and Americans.
And so I asked the bank executive, if people are always paying off their balances, how do you make money?
To be honest with you, very difficult.
Sen says only one in three credit card holders in China carry month-to-month balances. That's far less than developed Asian markets like Hong Kong, Singapore, and Taiwan, where more than 70% of consumers carry balances. And that's the bright spot in the credit card business. Sen says China's habits are bound to change. Just give it a little time. In Shanghai, I'm Lisa Chow for Marketplace.
crude lost $1.66 today, 106.23 at the close in New York. On any other day, that'd be a pretty decent amount. It'd be a big story. But oil has really been a big story all week as hedge funds and traders try to figure out what falling oil means and what they can do about it. Marketplace's Tess Vigeland is with us to talk about that story. Hiya, Tess.
Hello, Kai.
I want to take you back to Monday. You were hosting. I had the day off. Hurricane Gustav was in the Gulf.
Yep.
And oil was down $8-something dollars after having been up 87 cents in the run-up to the storm because of worries about the oil rigs. Question to you is, and that trend has continued this week,
yep,
why?
Part of it is the dollar is continuing to gain strength, mm-hmm, and the dollar pretty much moves in the opposite direction of oil prices. So we've got that. Also, high prices are now really starting to show through in less demand throughout the world. And because of that, the producers and the traders bringing down the price. You mm-hmm know, you want more people to buy more, you got to bring down the price. But Kai, I think this also points up the dangers of predictions. You know, earlier this summer,
right,
we heard from a lot of folks out there, oh my goodness, oil is going to hit 200.
Yep.
Well, here we are, and that hasn't happened, and suddenly the analysis is, well, maybe oil prices are going to stay where they are now. But really, do we know?
Yeah, we don't know.
Nobody knows. And, you know, for investors out there who decided early in the summer to get into energy because everything was looking great, not such a great idea. Yeah. You don't want to buy on the upswing.
Let me ask you the flip side of the demand question. There's a school of thought out there that says falling oil demand is not necessarily such a good thing because of what it implies. It implies that Walmart is taking fewer deliveries by truck, FedEx mm-hmm is making fewer package runs, and that is a sign in and of itself of a slowing economy.
And we just keep getting signs of the slowing economy. And certainly that is true. And, you know, the price of oil has not dropped down to where it was, say, a year ago. We were at $70
yeah,
a barrel
close,
a year
right
ago. So prices are still really high. And, you know, I'm going to predict that airlines aren't going to start handing out free blankets and pillows again because oil prices are still really up there. And it's probably safe to assume that that's not going to change anytime soon.
Let me ask you the seat of the pants question. And that is that there is a sense out there, if you talk to people, that despite the quarterly economic growth that we had last week of 3.3 in the second quarter,
right,
maybe things aren't all that good and it's a little shakier than anybody's letting on.
Well, overall economic growth doesn't necessarily translate to you and to me and to everybody else out there. I mean, in terms of how we're feeling, let me give you a few numbers here, and
sure,
then I'm going to ask you how you feel. Unemployment, 84,000 jobs lost, eighth month in a row mm-hmm of job losses. Inflation running 5.5% so far this year. 9% of homeowners who own mortgages are now in foreclosure. And history shows that September, on average, is the worst month of the year for stocks. So, Kai, how do you feel?
Yeah, here you go. There are two houses on my block in foreclosure. That's how I feel.
Not a pretty picture.
Marketplace's Tess Vigeland. She hosts our personal finance program. You hear it on the weekends. It's called Marketplace Money. Thanks, Tess.
Thanks, Kai.
Coming up, when chocolate might not be such a sweet deal.
I'm looking at where the prices are going, and looks like I might have to do some price increases because of the way the market is overall going.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials added on 0.2% today, 32 points to close at 11,220. The NASDAQ gave back 1.1% or 3 points. That's rather 0.1% or 3 points to finish at 2255. The S&P 500 gained 0.4%, 5 points, closed at 1242. For the week, the Dow fell 2.8%. The NASDAQ sheared off 4.7%. The S&P 500 lost 3.2%. Those unexpectedly high unemployment numbers coupled with rising home foreclosures sent the Dow down at the start of the day, way down. But financials helped bring things back. Shares in Lehman Brothers gained more than 6.75% on news that the investment bank may be bought out. Bank of America deposited 5.33%. Citigroup added close to a 4.25% gain. Phone giant Nokia hung up a nearly 8% loss after revising its earnings downward. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.7%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Areva, solutions for producing CO2-free energy and transmitting and distributing electricity. Online at us.areva.com. Whether you're busy or lounging around, the economic gears are always turning. Marketplace is available around the clock, too, as a podcast. Get your financial fix whenever you want it. Download the show and take it with you. Just head over to our website at marketplace.org and click on podcasts.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. In Washington, the Federal Reserve reports on consumer credit for July. It's the United Nations International Literacy Day. This year's focus is on the relationship between literacy and health. And on September 8, 1966, the sci-fi television series Star Trek premiered. Fans can go back in time and see the original series in reruns. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. Now that all the hooping and hollering of the conventions is done, John McCain and Barack Obama can get down to some serious campaigning. If they're smart, though, both of them have already started thinking about who they might like to have in their cabinet should they win in November. The president of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce weighed in this week. He said he'd love to see whoever the next president is keep Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson around for a while. Clearly, he didn't check with the man himself. Paulson's already said he's done next January the 20th. But commentator Bill McConnell has been thinking about life after Paulson and what the next Treasury Secretary is going to have to deal with.
Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson unveiled his blueprint for capital markets and regulatory reform in March, just as the credit crisis was cresting over Wall Street. In many ways, his creation now seems as rickety as the outmoded system he wants to overhaul. The plan has since been overtaken by political reality and his own ad hoc attempts to calm investors. Part of Paulson's plan included immediate initiatives to deal with the liquidity crunch. Longer-term ideas were aimed at bringing some sense to the overlapping patchwork of federal and state agencies that oversee commercial banks, Wall Street, and insurance companies. When he unveiled it, Paulson conceded that the most sweeping parts of his plan would take years to implement. But the Treasury Secretary will soon leave with the rest of the Bush administration. A new Congress and president will be handed the chore of restoring faith in financial regulation. And many of Paulson's most controversial ideas won't get much traction. There are sure to be vicious turf wars, and Congress must deal with actions Paulson made on the fly. For instance, which firms can tap federal borrowing and under what circumstances? There are also issues Paulson hasn't addressed. One is the shaky condition of the country's commercial banks and thrifts. They hold more than $3 trillion in federally insured deposits. Banks need to set aside more capital to cover bad loans. Congress may have to revisit whether that capital comes from new owners like private equity firms or non-financial firms like Walmart. It may be that Paulson has missed the core problem entirely. Does it really matter whether some banks answer to the Comptroller of the Currency and others to the Office of Thrift Supervision? No, the real problem is that we have become a society living on credit. We have bigger mortgages than we can afford, unfunded Social Security and Medicare obligations, and ballooning trade and budget deficits. The current economic mess is just another manifestation of America's attempt to delay a financial reckoning with more borrowing. Until Washington truly gets our economic house in order, future meltdowns are certain.
Bill McConnell is the Washington bureau chief for The Deal. That's a magazine that covers mergers and investment banking. You can send us your thoughts about what we cover. Go to marketplace.org and click on the link that says Contact. So, to sum up, we learned this morning the job market continues to be lousy. Consumer confidence is at historic lows. Food and gas are taking a bigger bite of household budgets. But one small business owner is betting that even in the face of adversity, consumers aren't going to lose their love of chocolate. From the Marketplace Entrepreneurship Desk, Minnesota Public Radio's Annie Baxter has a closer look.
Colin Gasco has waited months for this delivery.
Right outside would be great.
He tears open two bulky cardboard boxes with the enthusiasm of a kid in a candy store, or in a chocolate factory, to be more precise. At 23, Gasco owns this chocolate factory, Rogue Chocolatier. He launched it here in Minneapolis last fall. Today's delivery? Two big boxes of cocoa beans.
These are from Madagascar.
Most chocolate companies use already processed chocolate to craft their sweets. But Gasco buys raw beans and roasts and grinds them himself until they're in a liquid state. Then he runs the chocolate through a big squat machine with rollers, which he jerry-rigged for his purposes.
Most of the refining is done in here. It's passed through here several times until it reaches the proper consistency.
The result? Specialty chocolate bars with a high cocoa content, which have been drawing a lot of attention in gourmet circles lately. They're about the size of a Hershey bar. But where Hershey bars cost you about a dollar a pop, you pay a premium for rogue chocolatier, like at this Minneapolis store.
$7.48 is your total?
If that gives you sticker shock, think how Gasco feels. The price of cocoa beans has shot up 44% in the last 9 months. Gasco anticipated some of those increases when he started production last fall, but he's still a little stunned by the price of cocoa beans today.
I'm looking at where the prices are going, and looks like I might have to do some price increases because of the way the market is overall going.
Charging more for his chocolate would be a gamble, says Dilip Rao, an entrepreneurship specialist at the University of Minnesota's Carlson School of Management.
I would be very cautious if I was an entrepreneur at this time, instead trying to figure out what it takes to survive. It's tough to forecast what consumers will do.
Rao says every sector of American business is coping with the rising price of raw materials. Small businesses in particular are under pressure to pass along those costs, he says. Rogue chocolatier bars are aimed at wealthier consumers who might shrug off a small price hike or two. But, Rao says, in this faltering economy, Gasco risks alienating them.
There is always the possibility that customers change, and once they start to change habits, it becomes tough to bring them back.
But data from the National Confectioners Association indicates the fundamentals for Gasco's chocolate business are good. Premium chocolate sales increased about 30% between 2006 and 2007. Retail confectionery, on the other hand, increased less than 4% over the same period. And if Gasco hits bumps in his business, he's got a secret weapon, his dad, Bill.
My mother would kill him if I let him brag about himself, but he used to be a professor of entrepreneurship, so I do have a good resource.
He may not want to admit it, but maybe he does take after his father a little bit.
I've tried to read the look on your face.
I think that's a no comment.
Bill's not just an expert in entrepreneurship, he's also got a PhD in theoretical physics, which will come in handy. Gasco's planning to increase Rogue Chocolatier's production capacity tenfold in the next year, and father and son will work together on building the machinery. In Minneapolis, I'm Annie Baxter for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where a 529 plan can help meet your college savings goals. Details at putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note today, it's an update to a story we did a couple of weeks ago, quite possibly the first time a host of this program has spoken Korean on the radio. We told you the Ladies Professional Golf Association had come up with a new rule that its players had to be able to speak at least some English or they'd be suspended. Tournament sponsors weren't happy, the LPGA said, with stars who couldn't interact with fans. In its announcement today, tossing the English rule, the tour said it had received, quote, valuable feedback about it. What was left out was that it was sponsors providing that feedback, not too much of it positive. Here it is one last time, by the way, just because I know you can't live without it. LPGA in Korean, Yoja Pro Golpu Hyopwe. And that is Marketplace, which I don't know how to say in Korean, from American Public Media. Today, the Dow pumped up 32 points, 0.2%. The NASDAQ lost 3 points, 0.1%. The S&P 500 rose 5 points. That is 0.4% there. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste Wesson. The executive producer of the program is a guy named J.J. Yore. Coming up on Monday, weighing the costs of tuberculosis in Eastern Europe.
If people were not sick, there would actually be better opportunities for these people to contribute to the economy by their spending, by working, by contributing to the national income.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Have yourself a great weekend.
American Public Media.
With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.